Hello and welcome to Focus on Business. I'm your host, Lee Strickland. Now here's a reminder that the comments, views, and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of WCOM, its board, and underwriters. And now, today's program. Our topic today is government contracting, set-aside programs, how they work, who is eligible, and recent developments in those programs. I have two guests joining me here in the studio today, David Hayden and Jackson Moore of Smith, Anderson, Blount, Dorset, Mitchell, and Jernigan, LLP. I think I got those right.
You got it.
All right. So let me give you a little bit of background on both of them. Dave joined Smith, Anderson in 2011 after serving as general counsel and board secretary for U.S. Falcon, Inc. Dave has experience in government contracting, corporate investigations, internal in government, and employment law. He advises companies on corporate governance matters and other general and corporate business matters. He represents a variety of defense contractors, advising on a range of broad range of federal contracting issues such as bid protests, teaming agreements, subcontract agreements, joint ventures, and all the lovely things that we have to deal with as government contractors. Now, Jackson, his practice also focuses on government contracting, business dispute resolution, including litigation, mediation, and arbitration. And he has significant experience handling complex civil litigations, including class actions, shareholder and internal corporate disputes, breaches of contract, and trade practices. Thanks, guys, for being on the show today.
Thanks.
Well, thanks for inviting us on here, Lee.
Well, we're going to have fun talking about this topic because it is near and dear to my heart. At one point, about 90% of my business was cleaning up disputes and noncompliance around government contracts. So let's kind of give everyone a framework about what government contracting is and then what set-asides are.
Well, let me start. My interest and probably background in government contracting preceded joining the firm and joining as a general contractor with a defense contractor here in North Carolina. Was serving in the Army for 29 years. And part of that time, in fact, almost all of that time, was as a judge advocate. So you happen to run into one or two government contracts over the course of your career doing stuff like that.
So you were a JAG officer.
Exactly. Much more realistic than the TV show.
Than David James Elliott. Yeah.
I don't fly jets. I just jumped out of airplanes for a number of years.
Perfectly good ones, too, huh?
Oh, absolutely. Every jump you walk away from is a good jump.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Government contracting, I'll start off by those who work in the arena will tell you it's not for the faint of heart. It is fraught with a lot of landmines. I hate to use military analogies, but I do that a lot.
That's all right.
Landmines, and you learn very quickly what you don't know, and that can be overwhelming at times. But on the other end of that, rainbow that you're chasing is a very lucrative way to make revenue for a company and a way to also assist your country, assisting various government agencies. And it can be very, very lucrative for all those involved in it once you figure that out or you get the right people helping you through the process.
Creating the right systems, controlling your costs, managing your bidding process, making sure all the numbers work before you do something.
Well, and you know, having your certified payroll and making sure you're following the clauses that are in the agreement and so on and so forth. I mean, the one thing that I got involved in working with this because Martin Lancaster, who's a retired congressman from down east, was involved in setting up an organization called the North Carolina Military Business Center through the and it's paid for by your state tax dollars. It's funded through the community college system. And if Scott Dorney is listening, hello, Scott.
Scott should be. We've done several shows on the military things lately.
Excellent. But they there's probably the second largest. In fact, I think it's recorded that the second largest component of North Carolina's economy is tied to the military.
Right.
And there are a lot of opportunities for companies that want to do business with the federal government, be it military or non-military, to get involved. And we started becoming more actively involved really starting around 2001, 2002. And it's great to see businesses interact with the government, do it successfully. The government pays their bills, which doesn't always happen in the B2B context.
And fairly rapidly.
Usually fairly rapidly, and provided you get your paperwork done the way the government wants it.
And,
you
know, a fair, correct, and precise invoice as to the terms that you were supposed to send it in under.
Exactly. And so we've been involved with that really for the last 10 years or so. And again, there's some really interesting companies doing a lot of interesting things with federal agencies here locally.
Well, I know Scott and them, they monitor. So you register your NAICS code and stuff. And like, I was just looking, I had an opportunity hit my email box from NCMBC monitoring everything, his team out there. And so they're always able to update you and kind of keep you plugged in, so you're not always having to manually monitor everything. They let you know when something hits your code, so it's always great.
Well, and they've got a great staff that really wants to try to help small businesses succeed in this state. If you're a North Carolina company, they want to help you get your federal government contract, just like we do.
Yeah, we've done several workshops for them on the compliance end and understanding what it is to become a government contractor.
Well, you know, the North Carolina Military Business Center is a great asset for anybody who's just beginning to pursue government contracting, or even if you have been involved in government contracting for a while, it's a great resource. In addition to that, and complementary with the North Carolina Military Business Center, is an organization, a trade association, called the North Carolina Defense Business Association.
Right.
And it's a trade association for companies that are involved in government contracting and defense contracting, or those who want to. I've been on the board for a number of years and currently serve as the chairman of that organization. And we have over 250 companies in North Carolina and are growing, I'd like to say exponentially. And if you go to our website at NCDBA, just type that into Google and you'll get to our website, and you'll learn a whole lot about all these other companies that are actually here in North Carolina. And one of the main objectives of that association, in addition to educating our association members on government contracting, is the networking that goes on,
right,
the opportunities that we are able to identify, and advocating for our members, our member companies, which have almost 100,000 employees. And it's a great association to complement the information that's provided by the North Carolina Military Business Center.
Well, and we've got a National Defense Industry Association starting in the state, too. I was attending the meeting last week or the week before last, the organizational meeting. So,
did you go to that meeting in Spring Lake?
I did.
Did you see me there?
I did.
I walked in a little bit late, but I was there in time to meet all the players, and most of the players there are the same people that participate in the NCDBA, and I'm excited about a new NDIA chapter being formed here in North Carolina. They have, over 900 individual members?
It's like 982 or something like that.
It's a great national organization, and I would like to think it complements what the NCDBA, North Carolina,
right,
Defense Business Association, does here in North Carolina. We're uniquely focused on North Carolina, but the NDIA, I think, can work together with them and help grow the defense and government contracting business here in North Carolina, which really needs to grow.
Right. And I know I run a From Battlefield to Business program to help veterans in the active military start businesses, so that when they come out, they can do that. And so we're launching workshops around the state on those. We're going to do one at the National Guard headquarters and those kind of things. So,
are you familiar with Bunker Labs?
I am not.
That's another entrepreneurial idea, concept, that started in Chicago. They now have Bunker Labs,
okay,
all across the country.
Right.
And the most recent chapter was created in the Research Triangle Park over at the Frontier Center. And it's an opportunity for veterans who want to grow businesses or develop businesses can go through their free curriculum and receive a lot of mentoring from other parties. I've actually been over there on their brain trust on a Thursday, along with the CEO of a company I work with, and talking about working in the government contracting sector, and just a lot of great organizations. A lot of great veterans ought to take advantage of those kinds of opportunities in addition to what you are working on.
It's shocking. Here in North Carolina, we've had some of the other veteran groups on NC4Me and several of them. That our unemployment rate, not like our National Guard, is like 70-some%, and then out of people transitioning overall, our military across the country is about 30%. So we need to make those transitions. Another 90,000 are coming out of our military in the next couple years. So it's a prime time for them to take their experience working with government and come out, create businesses, create new technologies, solutions, and get back out there as government contractors.
And veterans make great employees, make great entrepreneurs. And if there's one thing they learn in their military service, in addition to being dedicated to whatever their task is before them, it's this initiative to figure it out. You know, if you're in the military, you've always had to learn to do with less and less and still achieve the objectives.
Right.
And they're just great employees. And so I encourage any listener who is even looking at employees, if you have a veteran's resume slide across your desk, give it a second look. It merits that.
Well, and you can actually go to nc4me.org, and if you have openings, they'll help you, you know, find those resumes and make those connections. But that's one of the set-aside groups, right? You start a business, there are veterans, service-disabled veterans, veteran set-aside,
yes,
women-owned business, small businesses, small disadvantaged businesses.
For those
businesses
who are knowledgeable, I'll apologize up front, but under the government's set-aside program, it's a powerful tool that the SBA essentially oversees for helping small businesses compete for and win federal contracts. And the federal government purchases approximately $400 billion in goods and services from the private sector every year. If a contract is being considered for release, seeking offers or proposals, they'll do market research. And if they decide that there are enough small companies that can do the work, then they can set aside that contract that only small businesses with the NAICS code, and you referred to it as a NAICS, it's really the North America Industry Classification System, and if you work in government contract, you'll learn that very quickly.
And you start knowing all of your digits.
Yeah,
that's right, all your acronyms.
A whole new set of acronyms. And they can set aside procurement for those type of special companies. And when we talk about special companies, it's also useful to understand that there are so many different options out there, whether you're a woman-owned small business or a service-disabled or a veteran-owned business or located in a hub zone or
historically underutilized business for the hubs. Yeah.
And the 8A program, which is another program that for socioeconomically disadvantaged businesses, because if you have that kind of a preference attached to your company and you meet the prerequisites, and it's almost different for each one.
Yes.
But if you meet that, it gives you an advantage in government contract. And if a set-aside contract is just set aside for veteran-owned companies or for woman-owned companies, which the government can do,
right,
it really whittles down the competition when you're trying to win a contract. Instead of going after, you know, competing with 20 other companies, you may only be competing with two or three other companies.
Well, and sometimes the larger contracts at Boeing and Northrop Grumman, those kind of things, have set-asides within their prime contract that they now need to subcontract certain percentages to these protected classes, too.
Yeah, the typical large contract is going to have an obligation for these large contractors to subcontract a certain amount of dollars or a certain percentage of their dollars down to small businesses of various types. And Congress has told the various federal agencies, we want money to go to these small businesses because those are the job creators in this economy. So if a company doesn't want to jump in with both feet and become a prime contractor straight out of the gate with the federal government, yeah, they should really be looking to finding opportunities to subcontract with some of these larger companies really early on. They need to be marketing and talking to these large contractors in the particular area of expertise that they have so that they can be ready. So when the time comes and the Boeings of the world are ready to go and pursue that contract, they know who you are. They know your business and what your capabilities are.
Well, and that capability, because I hear from the big guys a lot of times, is like, you need to go in and work with these small businesses because we would love what they're doing, but their business part is not structured properly. We have concerns about how they do their procurement. Do they have the right corporate and legal agreements in place? Are they doing their accounting correctly? Can they meet the standards of what they have to do when we pass through the requirements? Because all this money comes with strings.
Well, the federal government, they're right now especially, and it's been this way ever since 2008, ever since the economic catastrophe, the bubble that we were facing.
Recession is what an economist from NC State told me this morning. They call it the recession.
They call it
the
recession.
Great recession.
The great recession. Right.
And it's great that we're through that in large measure, but I know that certainly folks are still feeling the effects of it. But there's been a lot greater focus on compliance. The government put a lot of money into the economy, and tied into that was a lot of requirements that companies make sure that they, you know, cross their T's, they dot their I's, they are who they say they are. If they're a women-owned business, they're actually women-owned and
women-run.
And yeah, we can talk about that, sure. The government is really focusing on that as an enforcement area because they don't want a company that is not minority-owned, for example, to claim to be and then get a bunch of money that's supposed to be set aside for disadvantaged small business enterprise.
Well, and a lot of those requirements, they come in, shift how someone does business. If there's a prevailing wage agreement, and let's say they weren't at those wage levels, and now they come in and everything, and their payroll has to shift up to those cost structures.
Yeah, if you're involved in the construction industry and you want to get involved on a federal contract, whether you're a prime or a subcontractor, you've got a minimum wage requirement that is different from the federal minimum wage. It's under a law called Davis-Bacon, which you can Google at your convenience and read about. Same way with service.
If you didn't get it while you were in college,
Exactly.
Or you have insomnia.
That's right. Or if you have insomnia and you really need to get to sleep. Service contractors the same way. The government's going to set some requirements for fringe benefits and then for minimum wage requirements, and you need to comply with those. You need to know that before you place your bid.
Well, and a lot of times I get the calls where companies say, well, I have this little company here, and I own it, and then I have this one over here. And so they think by creating two tax entities, they've somehow not had to make those compliance rules stretch apart. But the government doesn't always look at it that way when it's a government contract.
Yeah, in fact, if you that brings out the word affiliation. And I know you were getting to that, but that's something that I think any small business owner has to be sensitive to in pursuing a particular contract that has a size limitation based on their NAICS code. And they may be underneath the average revenue over 3 years to pursue that contract, but if they are essentially tied in very closely, and the rules are pretty broad to determine if somebody is in fact affiliated with another company or companies, they can tie all the companies together, then all their resume is included in there because they're affiliated, and then all of a sudden they're no longer eligible for that solicitation. And they may not think that they're in danger when they pursue the contract, but somebody could submit a protest, a size standard protest, and it's the simplest thing in the world to do is write that letter to the contracting officer, and next thing you know, you're having to explain under oath all these different nuances,
right,
about how you're structured, and you may be too large.
Or something like on the grants, I was reviewing the grant applications for the government there for a while, and something would come in and I said, no, I need a size determination on this, because it was a small business grant program, and I'm like, I don't think this is a small business. And somebody said, what? I said, I'm a business reviewer. They have to meet the standard, or they're planning to offshore this. There's a requirement. You can't manufacture offshore. And so knowing those requirements, you have to understand what that impact is on your business then to do it. And like the joint employment ruling that came out from the IRS that's coming out, that will have an effect on whether Obamacare applies, FMLA, and then all these clauses get incorporated. And that one little piece of paper, we were talking about this before we went on air, I had one client get one sheet of paper that was the signature page basically for their contract. And we start following the URLs, and I was getting lost. And I finally just told the contractor's officer, I said, burn it on some CDs, and it ended up being two CDs.
Oh, wow.
And it was like 1,000 pages by the time we printed it out. And that took weeks to figure out what were the compliance requirements for that.
Well, if you go online and you're trying to respond to a request for proposals, the government, you know, they decide, look, we want to buy a certain number of services. We want a construction contract. We want this, that, and the other. They go and post online, you know, request for proposal, right? And they lay out all the requirements that are going to be in that contract. And then they say, and by the way, we're referring to...
Everything is incorporated by reference.
Yeah, because we're not going to go kill a bunch of trees.
Right.
In fact, there's a clause of federal acquisition regulation clause saying you will print double-sided on your paper. And they'll go ahead and they'll print 40 different contracts clauses that, and they won't say what the clauses are. You've got to go find them on the internet, which is to your point, right?
And you do, a lot of clients pay me to do nothing else but go through those FAR clauses because they're embedded in my brain. It's like, no, that guy hasn't changed his template. That one was eliminated, 10 years ago. He's still using the same template. And we go back and we scratch it. I said, no, you're not signing it because you're not complying with that. You don't have to. And you can spend 80 hours just going through the FARs and DFARs or HHSRs, but you really have to take the time to do it because there are things embedded in there that can be gotchas.
Absolutely.
Like we were talking again before we went on air, a Department of Defense contract. Who can work on the science? Who can execute it? And there are restrictions in certain organizations as to who can work, do the work.
Well, if you work in sensitive areas, they have a thing called ITARs, International Traffic in Arms Regulations, that put some restrictions on military-made products about who can have access to them. And if you have foreign nationals working in the company, and this is an issue with foreign companies that open up American subsidiaries, but also U.S. companies that hire in foreign nationals. And if they're not a green card holder or meet in one of the correct statuses, you could have an issue under ITARs that's going to really get the Department of State's interest and investigators as well. And there, you go back to compliance. If you're doing government contracting, you are going to be asked to certify certain things during the process. When you submit your proposal,
it can be your price, it can be your cost, it can be
it
your.
It could be your compliance, your status as a woman owned company,
systems,
or veteran owned, and.
Your IT security system.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there are. It can. That's why I said early on, it can be overwhelming when you think about it. But there are ways to work your way through that and to develop the expertise. And there are plenty of people with expertise out there that can
that you can rant like myself.
Yeah, there you go. Or ask questions. I tell my clients who do government contracting, in all my years in the military, I got used to working with commanders who were working 24 hours, 7 days a week, it seemed like. And I tell them, if you call me, in 5 minutes, I can tell you whether you need to go back to sleep or not, or whether you need to stay up. But if you wait till the morning, it's probably not going to get any better. It's going to get a lot worse, and you're not going to have slept well last night.
Well, and a lot of times people think, well, it's going to affect my accounting system, but it may affect your intellectual property rights. Because if the government may end up owning it, or they may have a royalty-free license, there's all these different things. There's things you have to report in a different way. What can you put on your website if you do a press release? What language needs to be in there? And it literally, it affects your HR, your compensation, and you have to understand that before you say yes.
And there are provisions that are unique to government contracting, a term called T4C. Termination for convenience. You may be going along.
It's kind of like employment at will.
Yeah, exactly. And if the government funding dries up, like when we had the recent challenges with the federal budget.
Sequestration.
That's a big word. And when that happened, all of a sudden contracts were stopped in their tracks. And it was a shocking experience for some companies who were unfamiliar with that possibility that's in their contract.
I mean, one client says, I got a $54 million contract. I said, no, you got a $1 million contract because it has to be refunded at the end of each year. They have to decide if you're taking the next year. If you worked all the years and got all of the money, it would be $54 million. Right, now you've got a $1 million contract.
And companies don't, in the B2B context, you've got a contract, it goes for 8 years, and I'm going to perform all 8 years, and we get all the money on that $54 million, and we're all going to be sitting fat and happy, and everyone is great. But the government doesn't do it that way.
No.
They have the right to terminate for any reason they want, and there is a limited amount of recovery you can get as the contractor if that happens. If the government typically will have, because they're operating off funding that's coming from Congress.
Right.
They're going to have a one-year contract, and they'll have a bunch of option years. So your first contract is almost, they may not like the way you're performing the contract. They may not pick up the next option year. That's kind of unusual, but, David and I have seen it happen in connection with companies from time to time, and we've had to be involved in trying to clean up the mess. And then you got to go the next year and try to perform. And it can be a challenge, especially if you're being involved in, say, a staffing contract that has a bunch of maybe 30 or 40 new employees you have to bring on board. And then you're only going to have them on for 1 year. How do you plan for the next year? Well, you need to work out some of your finances. Again, the government's great about paying their bills. So they'll pay for that first year if you do your work right. What about year two? How are you going to handle your employment relationships with these personnel if you're onboarding them for this brand new contract and so on?
Well, and the other thing is like with equipment purchases. So like the first year you may be doing small things and suddenly you have a $2 million or $3 million piece of equipment that has an 18-month lead time that you have to order in year one for year three to get the capacity, but you're not actually able to bill that to the contract at that point, or if they cancel on you because you only had a one-year contract technically, what do you do? It's like, well, I ordered the equipment. And I was like, but what did your contract say about that?
And did you negotiate it? Did you talk to your contracting officer, who's the government representative who has authority to negotiate and make changes to your contract? Have you talked to your contracting officer about, hey, you wanted me as a small business to do this work, and for me to go ahead and do this work, I've got to spend $300,000 on equipment.
Right.
And what's going to happen if we're at the end of year one and the government doesn't fund? What am I going to do? And you can, in limited circumstances, have the ability to negotiate some of those clauses so that you're not left high and dry if, for whatever reason, you don't get a renewal.
And the other question they have to ask is, am I going to own that equipment after? And if not, does that mean I have to let my competitor in my facilities, which has happened with some clients, that it's right in their manufacturing process. It's a $3 million piece of equipment, but the government's going to own it, and it says, well, I'm not buying 10 of these. And so anybody else that has a need for this needs to be able to come into your facility and use this because I own it. And it's kind of interesting to figure out, how do you keep everything proprietary and still give your competitor access to the same piece of equipment?
And there's no easy answer to that question.
It was movable walls that kind of dropped down like garage doors.
Oh, wow.
We can get creative when we're doing that.
Yeah, but contractors are not totally at the mercy of the government in these situations.
No.
And for example, in construction contracts, if contracts get terminated early, there are concepts like equitable adjustment where you can get reimbursement for some of your costs. You may not be able to recover profits, but you can certainly get reimbursement on your investment costs. And there are other ways that you can also get some sort of remedy or relief. So it's again, it's not so one-sided that you walk away with your pockets empty every time. And like I said, early on, it's not for the faint of heart, but there's some great reward at the end. And it's been an exciting time working in this field for a long time.
Well, it is, and it's like you have to understand that you can make great money, but in some contractors for defense, they'll issue and you can't make more than a 10% profit. You know, you see those come through, or some of the agencies say 7% profit on something. And so you're dealing with those and you have to understand what that means, because a lot of times it doesn't even really mean real profit because they've excluded things that can be charged to the projects. So for some of the small business programs, it's like you can't charge your patent costs, or you can't do marketing, or you can't do these different things. And so when we get those contracts, we really have to understand and dig into them and understand, okay, you've just committed to a $5 million project, three of which the government is giving you, two of which you need to find, $2 million you need to find somewhere from some other source.
You should have known that before you bid, right? So one of the things you need to go back is step back. You got to take a look at this proposal. Can I even do the work? Am I qualified to do the work? If it's set aside, am I properly within the set aside? And then you need to start breaking out these pieces and saying, well, is there a minimum wage requirement under the various acts for this work? And how do I price that in order to take advantage of that? Am I going to own the intellectual property when all this is done? And how am I going to price that? Is it worth anything to me? Am I going to have to buy American-made equipment, which is typically a requirement if you're selling stuff or building stuff for the government? The government wants American-made steel and American-made products with some, you know, there's a not a hard and fast rule, but there's a little bit of wiggle in there. You got to look at all that before you build your bid.
It's like U.S. carriers for your travel, I mean, shipping, different things that comes in there. Now, I mean, it literally, you have to understand that as you're going through. There's always, and when you find it, then you can go back and have a conversation. We do that frequently with small businesses. The reality is, it says, well, you have to travel coach. Well, if somebody is 7'6", they're not traveling coach when they get on the airplane. And so you're aware of things that you have to get exceptions to.
No, they're going in the cargo hold.
They're first class in the first row, you know, usually they're somewhere. But it's, you know, it's having to understand those little idiosyncrasies so that you're not unable to get reimbursed for travel, and especially when the contracts have a lot of travel on it, and you're going from this facility to that facility, you're doing testing. One client had to go to Hawaii to test their products, so we had to build in the six-week test period for all the scientists to be in Hawaii to do all the various testing. Tried to get the consultants built in, but that didn't work. But so you have to realize all the different things that will come in to play and to be able to have those conversations with the contracting officer and all those agencies to see what's going to come into play.
You know, we started off this conversation talking about set-aside and one way that the government can engage in the procurement. You also have your full and open competition where any company competes with any other company. But we also have, there's a distinct advantage if you are a small company, like a woman-owned small business or an 8A or a service-disabled veteran. The government has the ability to sole source a contract to that individual. And I can't tell you how, you know, you're only competing with yourself. You get it's actually handed to you. And that's one of the ideal situations for somebody just starting out. If they're able to reach that point where they are very competent as a small business and are in compliance and are really good at what they do, and then they are able to develop the relationships with the contracting officers at wherever they are looking for business, and the contracting officer decides to sole source that particular contract.
Right.
To a company, you are handed that contract on a silver platter, but you have to perform. One of the newer features of in government contracting that's happened in the last 3 to 4 years is this consolidation of different databases into the systems of award management, SAMs. And everybody that does government contracting has to be registered in there. It's very simple. But once you're registered in there, that's the simple database that every contracting officer checks when they look at proposals that have been submitted on contracts. And it's your report card.
It's your prior performance. It's
exactly.
What happened. Did you invoice correctly? Were you compliant? Did you deliver on time? Was it a quality? Did they accept it?
Were you evaluated
right.
As having performed satisfactorily, or are there some issues that had to be dealt with? And it's something you need to pay attention to, because if you're working on a contract and you're not doing a good job, that's going to stay with you. And you need to work out the issues and perform that contract. I knew a 8A company, a small socioeconomically disadvantaged company that was a technology company. And since they were just starting out, the Small Business Administration, who provides essentially people to counsel and,
right.
and mentor those companies, offered them a plumbing contract and for over $1 million. Well, that's a lot of money when you're a small company. Think, wow, we can do this. I'll just go hire a plumber. They're not a plumbing company. And the CEO prudently said, that's not my
right.
wheelhouse. That's not my specialty area, and I'm not going to go that route. So you have to fight that temptation for having things handed to you that on their face look like they're wonderful, but really when you peel back the onion, it's not something you need to get into, and focus on what you're good at.
Well, and sometimes you see those contracts and you have to sit down, and if you're going to have to change your business substantially, it's going to have ripple effects.
Yeah.
And so you really have to sit down and say, okay, this is what my specialty is, and yes, I could perform this, but that would require me to do these things. And am I willing to do that? Am I willing to go into debt to finance some aspect of it? Am I willing to take on investors if I need the funding? Because something usually has to change in your organization to fund that growth up front.
And one of the things that you're talking about the Military Business Center again, you know, Scott Dorney talks about is that, well, you know, are there financing vehicles to be able to handle this kind of opportunity? Because, again, the government's going to pay their bills. But if you're a company that is a small business that suddenly lands a multi-million-dollar contract, it's going to require a bunch of people to be brought on board and more equipment to be purchased and so on. Is there financial capacity? Are the banks going to give you the letter of credit and the other financing that you need to be able to perform?
Well, and sometimes the businesses assume, well, I can factor this like any other receivable. And I'm like, okay, because I get them from the bank. So the bankers are calling me. It's like, Lee, I'm going to send you this. Can you look at this and tell me, can it be factored? And I'll look at it. It's like, no, that one can't be factored. This one could, but it's only a one-year contract. It's really, he's representing it's $6 million, it's $600,000 because it's not funded fully. And you go through these things, and suddenly the small business thinks, And then I'm going back to the banker. I was like, he hasn't signed all these. He can go back and ask for advance payment under certain conditions for certain things and negotiate that.
And sometimes you also have something called the Prompt Pay Act,
right,
which is a federal law that requires especially small businesses to be paid more quickly than other businesses when contracts are being fulfilled. And if the government doesn't pay, they're supposed to voluntarily tack on some interest in order to make sure that the company isn't strung out too far. Now, does that always work in practice? No. But you've got in North Carolina last year $5 billion in federal contracts that were awarded to North Carolina prime contractors. So we're all talking about all the scary pitfalls of being a federal contractor. There's a reason why there are all these companies trying to get this work.
Well, and it's from the standpoint of being aware, because I think some people think that's that pot of gold, I got it, and now it's just all the money is going to start coming in. But then the auditor walks in to audit your accounting system, or they do a desk audit to make sure everybody's timesheets. You know, that's like, this minefield like you were talking about earlier, because a lot of companies don't keep timesheets. So mm-hmm. why would your CEO keep a timesheet? Because he's also the chief scientist. He's working on the project, and he has to keep a timesheet. They come in, they check timesheets, and no one's timesheet's current.
And you need to have a good accounting system put in place. I mean, in some contracts, especially construction, a lot of construction that's been going on down east, especially at Cherry Point and at Fort Bragg, over the last 5 or 10 years in connection with what's called BRAC, Base Realignment and Closure. And it's interesting, there are discussions about, are we going to have another BRAC that may wind up providing more benefits to the state. If you're engaged in construction, you need to have certified payroll. If you're the chief scientist and the chief ball washer, you can only assign some of those hours over to the federal government for payment, depending on the type of contract that you have, whether it's fixed price or time materials and so on. So, there's definitely some things that you need to be paying attention to before you jump into this space in order to make sure you're compliant.
And the first thing, if you're thinking about doing it, you talk to your lawyer. Or find a lawyer that's experienced in it. Same thing if you have an accountant, ask them if they're experienced in it, because again, not everyone understands government contracting rules and those kind of things. So you need to find the people who are in there and doing it on a day-to-day basis that stays current with the bazillion legal changes and guidances that come out, it seems like, every week.
Well, there's a great, the American Bar Association, which is open for attorneys and the like, they have their own public contract section. And, Marshall Doak from Dallas, who I was with a firm with that he was in down in Texas a number of years ago, good opportunities to keep up with the issues that are going on at hand and all the changes that are going on in this thing called the Federal Acquisition Regulation, which are essentially, your contract clauses. They're changed all the time. They're subject to political, changes.
And then each agency does their variation of it. So the Department of Defense has one. Health and Human Services has one.
Absolutely.
And they don't always correspond to each other when you receive monies from both agencies.
Absolutely. And the other thing that's happening too, the administration has been issuing a series of executive orders, and those are being turned into new FAR clauses, and those are focusing on certain socioeconomic requirements, things like human trafficking, things like making sure there's non-discrimination, and companies need to be aware of those things. They need to have policies put in place. It doesn't need to be super complicated, especially if you're a small business. That's one of the benefits of being a small business. You can turn a dime and you can set a policy very quickly.
But if you set the policy, you have to follow
that. Oh, yeah. You can't just put it on paper and ignore it. And that's a very good point.
Because you get in more trouble for having a policy you don't follow than when they come in and audit and you don't have the policy at all.
That goes back to the set aside issue you were talking about.
Yeah, and the certification process. But, and I feel like to get our tone a little bit has been to scare people away from government contracting. And I would like to talk a little bit about teaming and how that is a great advantage to what I call preference companies, women-owned, hubs-owned, service-disabled veteran. And if it's a set-aside contract and you are one of the preferences for that. You can always team with other companies. You know, the requirements that you have to do a majority of the work or at least get a majority of the profits remains, but you can team with other companies that have tremendous capabilities that you may not have. And then as that team, you're a much more attractive potential award winner on that contract.
Right, a woman-owned business can team with a service-disabled veteran's
or
business.
With other small businesses.
Right.
And depending upon the nature of the government's acquisition strategy, who they're trying to target with the set-aside, you can team with other companies. You create a teaming agreement and with the idea that if you win the contract, then you would be the prime, and these would be subcontractors. So then you have subcontracting agreements that have to be created as well. But then all of a sudden, you're the prime, you're running the show, and you have subcontractors who are working with you to perform on that contract.
And you could have some situations, if you're a small business, where you can subcontract with a company that's not small, and the government may still find that to be okay as far as setting aside to the small business because, again, if you're the small business, you're the one who is in the hot seat, but then you also have a large subcontractor behind you who may have experience.
They may have the infrastructure, too.
Absolutely.
There's some things that you're not going to invest in a $20 million test lab, which with a larger business, they may already establish that.
Absolutely. And if that company, if that's small, you can't, sort of offload your requirements down to the subcontractor, but you certainly can rely on the experience of that teaming partner, and the government wants you to rely on those companies if it helps you perform, so long as you can perform, the aspects of the contract you're
right.
supposed to be performing, because again, the government doesn't want to just have kind of pass-through arrangements where you have this kind of small business in front, but all the money's
they
really
don't want a shell
large.
Structure.
No,
they want a tangible small business that's actually executing part of the contract.
And again, to the discussions we were talking about earlier about federal enforcement, you've got companies that are being subject to federal investigation and prosecution because they are essentially acting as those pass-throughs that you described. And the government says, no, this money is supposed to be given to a disadvantaged business enterprise, call it woman-owned or veteran-owned, and you're not really doing the work. You can't do the work. You're having this great big contractor do the work as your sub, but you're not really able to do any of it on your own. And we're going to prosecute you for that. We're going to prosecute the subcontractor for that.
Well, and to Dave's point, we're not trying to be really negative about it. It's just like you need to be aware these are the things. So here's the pot of gold. You make a business strategic business decision to become a government contractor. You start looking for opportunities. You read those opportunities to understand what will it change in my business? What funding do I need? What do I need to get my lawyer to help me with? Do I need to team with someone, or do I want to create a formal joint venture for some reason and
you
create a
that.
Separate legal entity, which happens more frequently with my clients with when they have intellectual property and somebody else has the contracting and business experience. They create this joint venture, says, I'm bringing this and I'm bringing this, and legally we're going to do it this way. And then you go through that process, but you really need to go through that process to know, what am I signing up for?
Absolutely, because it's not once you wind up starting down the road, if you wind up having good performance on your contracts and you're compliant, you wind up getting added to this system that the government has to look at.
It becomes a little bit like drinking from a fire hose for some of the clients.
Well, it can be.
Because they might be a service-disabled veteran and the only one that does that with the past performance they have.
Right, because if you do, one of my partners used to tell me the reward for good work is more work, Jackson.
Right.
So, and if you have a good relationship with the federal government in a particular area, they're going to want to come back to you for more work. And if that happens, then suddenly one successful contract can reap multiple successful contracts, and then you've got a great opportunity to build on your past success.
And you have that funding demand, too, though. So the faster you grow, the more cash flow you need
right.
to fund that growth, to stay at that performance level, to keep your commitments in your contracts.
But what a problem to have. You know, suddenly I'm going
too fast and I'm going to go bankrupt now.
and that's a strong balance. I've seen small companies with some initial success grow their overhead too quickly. And they might have a credit line with the financial institution that all of a sudden they have these covenants they have to comply with, and they start living the high life because they're bringing in all this revenue, but then they have to pay subcontractors and they have to pay their employees, and that can get a little bit upside down. And so you have to be, have to strike a good balance. You have to be a good business person and have good sense on the revenue, what's coming in, what's your cash flow, what's your P&L. Look like, right. and sometimes they can get a little carried away. I can recount over and over again the number of conversations I've had with companies that they were not a special company, and so the owner would say, "Well, I'm just going to make my wife the owner of the company." Well, does she even work in the business? Well, no, but I want to be a woman-owned company. That's not going to do it. That's certainly not going to survive any kind of diligence or review. You have to be compliant.
And that's why a lot of the women-owned businesses and things have, and some of the others have formal certification, independent certification groups that will come in and help them go through that process of becoming a certified woman-owned business.
Absolutely.
That you're substantially controlled, you were funded, all of those, and you go through all those steps to hit that standard. And for some businesses, it's worth that extra step because you also have private sector that have government contracts that come back and say, well, if you're already a certified woman-owned business, that saves me a step. That makes me a little bit more comfortable.
And you have some very large companies in RTP that will bring on board subcontractors if there's some independent entity that's certifying your status as women-owned or veteran-owned or so on. And in some instances, you can self-certify. You can go to the federal government and say, well, I am,
that's what I did with mine,
or whatnot. Yeah. And then you can go ahead and proceed. But other instances, the government is going to be calling on you to present some evidence of third-party certification. And there's David and I were talking the way over, exciting government contracting discussion.
Some of us do enjoy it.
About sort of whether the SBA will allow you to, it says on their website, to still self-certify, and there's a debate among lawyers about whether you can do that because Congress changed the law effective the end of 2014 and removed the ability of a company to self-certify, and well, what is the SBA doing here? And that's been
I frequently ask that question about several government agencies when I see guidance that comes out that's in conflict with, they'll say this is mandatory for a small business, and it's like, actually, no, the small business has to give you the content. They don't have to use your 300-tab Excel spreadsheet to generate that content, and you're going through those kind of things because something you can do in 8 hours suddenly becomes a 200-hour project for your accounting department, and it doesn't have to be that way, right? And so you end up pushing back against the auditors about things that you need to report. Well, we have to have it. And I'm like, you don't need to know the income of my board of directors, and it's that kind of stuff. That has nothing to do with them being on my board and going through those kind of conversations. So that starts, which auditor are you dealing with?
Contracts get larger, sometimes they can try to get down into the weeds. And the rule that came out about 5 years ago about listing the salary of your top five employees,
that got
a lot of people's attention. And why do I have to do this? And what business is this of theirs?
Well, and it's, I tell my clients, it's like you can pay as a government contractor anything you want, any level you want. The government may limit the part of that you can charge them. And as a taxpayer, I'm frequently happy about that. So if everybody in your organization is suddenly making over that minimum threshold, then that's fine. You just have to have investors or you have to have profits or whatever to pay the difference out of and be able to show that. So what are the biggest challenges in pursuing the set-asides?
I think the SBA sets out two kind of very broad requirements to make sure that companies are actually who they say they are. And the first one is ownership. There has to be, and I don't want to get too deep in the weeds, Yeah, we only have 5 or 10 minutes left. you have to have ownership, you know, unconditional ownership within the person who, if it's women-owned, it's
that a woman. Satisfies that set-aside requirement.
It's got to satisfy the set-aside, exactly.
So it has to be that person or a combination of people that have that set-aside demographic.
And it's got to be 51% or higher. It can't be 50.0. It can't be 50.1. It's got to be 51%. You know, if you don't like it, call your Congress person and have the law change. But the other requirement, and this has been in effect for a long time, is control. And that is where a lot of companies fall down because they may say that they're a woman-owned business, but and the woman may own 51% because in some ways that's kind of easy to do. But the woman is not actually involved in some of the day-to-day management operations.
Not the key decision maker for the organization.
Right. And you can have that person just be named as president, but if she's not actually doing the work, then it's really not a woman-controlled business, and then the things fall apart. And the SBA, again, is getting very detailed into this and making sure that the person who is named as the woman owner is actually involved in the day-to-day operation, not everything in the business. I mean, you have multiple employees because you need to have those.
Use a military term, in the command and control of the business.
That's right.
So they have to be aware of the financial decisions, what is going on.
They need to be at the workplace. They need to be present. And they need to be the
it's
person that makes
stamp.
The decision. And I'll see situations where a minority investor would have veto authority over decisions. Well, then you no longer control that.
We have that sometimes with the spin-outs out of universities around the country. The way they're structured, the university, it may be a small business, and they may not have the substantial control from the way the ownership is, but they're doing the accounting, they're making the decisions, they're providing the office space, they have 3 of the board seats, and so yeah, it's part of the university.
And that brings back, I think, probably the one point I would tell a listener who's interested in going down the government contracting route, set it up correctly at first. Do the investment up front. Get the expertise from whatever source that's going to allow you to have the ability to go forward with the comfort and confidence that you know you have a correctly set up company and now also know who I can reach back to when issues arise.
Well, and it's cheaper to set it up correctly than it is to clean it up. I know the first 4 years of my business, 90% of my clients were cleanups from having received government funds. They hadn't complied with timesheets, their accounting systems, all these kind of things. And it's thousands and thousands of dollars, you know, usually 5 figures at least, you know, low to mid, where if you sit down with an attorney and spent $2,500 on your incorporation, your policies and procedures, employment agreements, you know, and then you don't try to do your own patent filings and those kind of things if you don't have the expertise, it's better to make that investment than think, well, I can fix it later, and you suddenly find out you fail the audit and, you know, you're on the hook for interest, penalties, you know, exclusions, all these kind of things because you didn't set it up and you didn't think it was that big a deal.
And here's where the cleanup can kind of manifest itself. You present yourself as, say, women-owned small business, and you go and you win a contract that's been set aside for women-owned small businesses. Well, and you have the lowest price, so hooray. We're marching down the road together. We're going to make all this money. But you know, a couple days later, there's a notice from the second place bidder of something called a protest, size protest, saying we don't think this company is really women-owned and women-controlled, and we protest. And what will happen then is that goes to the contracting officer, which in turn goes to the SBA. The SBA sends this form saying, fill this out in 5 days. And it's everything about your government, your organizational status, who owns shares, you know, are they subject to any kind of restrictions, and you know, who's running the company, what other companies do the owners own, because that's relevant for whether or not you're small, because the SBA piles all that stuff on. And you have a very short window of time to address those. If you address them, if you have everything put up in the front end, and it's all, then you don't have to worry about it because you've already got everything set up. If you don't think about it until you actually have the award, it's kind of too late to really fix it. So we like to get involved before there's an issue, before the company is even formed, try to set it up right, then you don't have to worry so much about having to fix something because there's nothing to fix.
Well, and it's, I mean, we just have a few minutes, and real quick, but I'm going to say I'd been in business about 6 years, so it would have been about 2007, 2008. I got a call from one of the biotechs in the area, and they'd been in business, I want to say, 15 years or so, and the CEO called to ask a question about his 1099. I'm like, why do you have a 1099? And one, I don't do taxes, but I'll point you in the right direction. And he's like, well, I get it from the company. I'm like, but you're an employee of the company. He goes, oh, we decided not to do payroll. We just 1099 everybody. And I'm like, okay. I was like, here's my advice. You got to call your patent attorney. You got to call your corporate attorney. You got to call your CPA, because that isn't the way you get to decide this. But I think they'd been 14 years, if I recall correctly. And for that entire 14 years, they had never run a payroll.
Oh, wow.
And that's so amazing. It was just like, and the lawyer's coming. He goes, how did you find this? I said, he called to ask me a tax question. He goes, you don't do taxes. I know, but aren't you glad he called me? Because that was just, you know, there was a whole change in upper management, the board. I mean, there was everything changed. Because people were not aware that part of the compliance things that you're also saying when you come in is, my taxes are current. I'm a going concern. I can execute this. We have the skills, we can acquire them. I'm using employees. Sometimes it's required, not 1099 people, all of those kind of things. And it's making all of those things work.
Going back to what I said earlier, set it up correctly to begin with. It's like the transmission commercial. You can pay me now or you can pay me later, but you're eventually going to need the right expertise.
And it's much more painful later.
because then it's an emergency. So you know, set it up in the front end, then you don't have an emergency later. It works out great for everyone.
Well, and if you set it up correctly, it actually takes less time to do it. It's integrated in your business system. So if you're going to record it and you have to track the cost by job, then you have your system that does, you know, tracks your projects by job, and you know what's affiliated with what. You can calculate those overhead rates and get them correct, and you can negotiate those and things, and it makes it much more, you're able to sleep at night consistently without having to call your attorney at 11 o'clock at night hyperventilating wondering, did I mess this up? Gentlemen, thank you for being on the show. If you have one last quick little tip, what would it be?
When you set up your company, be a company that has values, and make sure every employee understands and knows and follows those values, and stick to that, and you will be able to circumvent and deal with whatever comes your way.
Well, I want to thank you both for being on the show again, and everyone, until next time, stay focused on the important things. If you would like to become an underwriter for Focus on Business, or any of the WCOM FM LP 103.5 programs or the station, visit the WCOMFM.org website for information on underwriting shows, becoming an individual sponsor, becoming a Golden Voice sponsor, or how to volunteer with the station. That's WCOMFM.org. We're on the air because you care and you underwrite our programs. Focus on Business is underwritten by Focus Resources. Their website is focusresourcesinc.com. That's focusresourcesinc.com.
stars are for remembering the glory and the victory where proudly we can say, oh, this is freedom.